Welcome to the Lavo Show podcast. Conversations with outstanding human beings whose love has been inspired and transformed by Osho. Take a deep breath and enjoy the show.
Hello and thanks for tuning in. My name is Swaram and I'm the host. Today our guest is Abhijana. Abhijana is an author and a doctor of oriental medicine with 42 years experience in the art of acupuncture and Chinese medicine. Abhijana took sannyas in 1977 and had the honor of healing Osho's body. I'm so happy to have Abhijana on the show and I hope you enjoy it. Abhijana, welcome to the show. How are you?
Thank you, Swaram. I'm very well.
Great. So to start, tell us a bit about how you came across Osho.
Well, I feel like I've been a spiritual seeker my whole life, being born in California. The way Osho talks about Californians, that was me. I experimented with a lot of people and a lot of so-called masters and many different meditations. But I came across Osho by divine accident. I had just finished acupuncture school in England, and I went overland from England to India because I always was fascinated by India. Even as a child, I read everything I could about India, and I wanted to meet a yogi in a cave who could get me enlightened. That was kind of my vision of India. And so at the age of 23, I arrived in India. And along the way, I met sannyasins who were also traveling the overland trail in those days. That was 1976. And they all were coming either from or to Pune. And they said, "Oh, you're going to India. You're going to see Bhagwan Osho." And I said, "No, I'm just going to India." And they said, "Oh no, you're going to see Bhagwan." And I said, "Well, maybe, but I don't have a strong pull for him. I didn't know that much about him." And then they said, "Well, you know, 99% of everyone who goes takes sannyas." And I said, "Well, if I do go, I'm probably going to be the 1%. I'm not going to do that." So at any rate, I arrived in India. And I went straight north to Dharamsala, the Dalai Lama's residence in North India in Himal Pradesh. And I was very happy there. I got a job translating Tibetan medical texts from kind of a very rough Tibetan English into a better English. And I was just very happy there. But I ran out of money, so I ended up asking my parents for money. And I had originally asked them to send it to Bombay, to Mumbai. So I ended up leaving Dharamsala and going all the way down to Mumbai to collect the money, which wasn't there. So I went to Pune only because I had a friend from the acupuncture school who I knew was there, and I thought I could borrow money from her. So that's how I ended up in Pune.
Okay. So you ended up in Pune, and tell us what happened then when you entered the gate of the commune.
It's a kind of magical story in my view. I came that first night, and I had been traveling overland for many weeks, and I had never seen so many Westerners for about 6 weeks in one place, you know, walking around in orange clothes. And I felt like I was back in the Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco, where I was born, all these hippies. And I didn't like the place. I didn't really feel any connection that day. And then I was dancing in the music group at night, and I thought, "Oh, this is nice. I'm enjoying the music." And a guard tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Excuse me, are you a sannyasin?" And I said, "Well, look at me. I'm dressed in other color clothes. I obviously wasn't a sannyasin." And I said, "No." And they said, "Well, you have to leave at sunset." At that time, they had a rule because there was some stealing going on. So they were asking non-sannyasins to leave at sunset or in the dark. I guess it was sunset. And anyway, I got into a fight with the guard, or an argument, saying, "What's the difference between you and me? You're wearing orange. I'm wearing blue." And they literally dragged me out to the front gate. And as I was ready to just get back on the next bus to Mumbai and wait for the money to come, I was really finished, but it was late at night. I didn't know really what to do. And at the gate, the head guard at that time was a beautiful Indian man named Sant. And he saw his guards dragging me out, and he said, "Do you need a place to stay tonight?" And I thought, "Well, yeah, I do." And he said, "Here." He gave me the key to a room in Mobo's hotel. And he didn't ask for money. He didn't ask what my name was. He just gave me somebody's key to stay. And because of that gift, I did stay. And I met Osho the next morning, and the rest is history.
That's wonderful. Okay, so we'll have a chance to talk a little bit more about you and Osho later on. But for now, let's jump into the main topic of today, which is about medicine, healing and acupuncture, which is your field of expertise and your speciality. Within the world of alternative medicine, acupuncture has received the most favorable support by the scientific community. And in my understanding, it could be described as a method of balancing and building the body's life force or energy. Personally, I see Osho as a master of energy. He created Buddha Field, Energy Field. His meditation techniques works very much on awakening our life force. And of course, the Energy Darshan experiment during the 70s was very powerful and direct way to awake energy in his disciples. So within this context, how, in your view, Osho's approach on energy and traditional Chinese medicine are related?
Ooh, that's a big question. To answer that, I think I can only give my personal experience. Osho, I feel, really trained me to use acupuncture and Chinese medicine in a way that very few practitioners do. He literally sent me people from Darshan to have sessions, people who in the Western world would be considered mentally unstable or psychotic or schizophrenic or in some ways, or just some energy phenomenon. And he said, you just have a little electrical issue in the brain. You go see Abhyana and a few sessions, you will be fine. And I was often in Darshan when he said these. And I thought, what am I supposed to do with these people? Because my training, even though it was a traditional Chinese medicine training, is still a Western. I learned it in the West, and even in China, it's become very Western. So what Osho is bringing is, I feel, more the traditional Eastern right brain, intuitive healing aspect to it that is a great gift to receive from him. And sometimes I feel like he just chose the points through me to work on people. So I only found out when I left Pune and came back to America and started working in a clinic again with just so-called regular people, not necessarily sannyasins, where I realized what a gift it was that he gave me.
Okay, so I'd love to dig a little bit deeper in that, what you mentioned about electricity and that people who would be considered in the West mentally unstable and whatever, and Osho would laugh it off and just say, you know, go to Abhi and he'll fix you. And it's all about electricity, really. Can you expand and explain a little bit more on that?
Yes. Chinese medicine is based on the balance of yin and yang. Most people know that. And it's, but most people don't really have a very existential experience of what it means and what that balance of yin and yang in the body can be. And the one context was in the ashram in India, treating people who are intensely meditating, who are having what in the West might be called kundalini experiences. I say in the West because I live in Sedona, and in Sedona, everybody has kundalini experiences. And nobody really knows what it is, but they do have strong energy experiences. And I feel like, I've been trained in a way by Osho to work with these people in a way that is not written in any Chinese books or not, part of any traditional acupuncture training. So that's one aspect of it. And, theoretically, the balance of the yin and yang in the body and the balance of all the meridian energies in the body, one has health. But where Osho was taking it is in a different level, where he said that acupuncture was the medicine of the second body. In the lectures in Patanjali Yoga, he talked about that Western medicine is perfectly capable of treating the physical body, where acupuncture works on the second body, the non-physical body.
Okay, that's fascinating. And I remember reading Osho, there is a book where I think he talks about seven bodies. So things can go beyond yes. And beyond. Yeah. But for me, the second body is more than enough, I think.
Well, I feel acupuncture works on the interface between the physical body and the second body, which some people call the emotional body. Some people call the etheric body. And then there's the third body, the astral body, and the fourth body, and the fifth body. And he said there are different medicines for different bodies. And it makes sense to me because acupuncture can affect the physical. Anybody who's had acupuncture treatment knows that. But it does work on another level too. And it brings a sort of harmony to the being. So one just feels well, not necessarily healed of their physical body issue, but they feel well. And that's one aspect that's, I feel, somewhat unique to acupuncture.
Let's talk a little bit about the Osho Divine Healing Training. I understand you were the leader of the Osho Divine Healing Training. Can you explain to us what that is and how the school came about?
Yes. Prashantam and I were both the co-leaders of the Divine Healing Training, and later Duren, English Duren. And we it started out because Prashantam and I we've been friends for years. And in Pune 2, whatever years that was, 1987, 88, we talked about offering trainings. And it was a time in Pune, at the Multiversity, that the groups were moving away, or at least not just week, you know, one-day groups or weekend groups or 1 week, but actually into trainings. So the rebalancing training came into effect, and other bodywork trainings were coming in, craniosacral, many other trainings, actually, hypnosis training. At any rate, he and I, we said, let's do a training together, and let's, you know, do an oriental healing or oriental medicine training, because Prashantam is a master of shiatsu, as well as the oriental kind of approach to the body. And we were very complimentary, I felt, at that time. So we asked Osho for a name for it, and we put a few suggestions in, and he rejected all the names and said, no, call it Divine Healing. And I my first reaction was, what? Divine Healing? What a name. It's like in America, that's kind of what the evangelicals do. They channel the Holy Spirit and they lay hands on people. So I had a reaction to the name, but it became very beautiful. The training started that way. And we did many trainings, both in India and in Miasto, in Italy.
And was it about traditional Chinese medicine and acupuncture?
It was about traditional Chinese medicine, both from the Chinese and the Japanese point of view, which is what Prashantam's more in his angle. But also about acupressure. We weren't actually using needles, but we did give a lot of the theory it was a 3 month long training. And I would say we gave a lot of the theory of the first year of an acupuncture school, but we did a lot with our hands. We know it was a hands-on technique. So it wasn't just using, not only acupressure, but also moxibustion, which is the burning of herbs on acupuncture points. We did that, as well as shiatsu. And Prashantam and I really took it and developed it into something I thought really unique.
Great. So the next point I wanted to discuss with you is that at some point you have been asked to give Osho some healing sessions. So I'd love to hear, how did that happen and how was to heal Osho's body?
Well, it was a dream come true. It was at a time where quite a few body workers were working with Osho, Satyarthi, Anubhuta, Leela, among others. And I was giving sessions to Anando, Australian Anando in Pune, and she started to inquire about what we could, you know, do for Osho. And one day she simply said to me, get your equipment ready, clean it well, we're going to do a session. And like I said, it was a dream come true. I called to America that night to my old acupuncture mentor, a Taiwanese woman, Miriam Lee, to discuss what to do. And, you know, I was so nervous, I didn't sleep a wink that night. And the next morning, I gave him a session. You want me to go in more detail, I know.
Yes, exactly. That's just an appetizer. I'd love to hear the full story.
Okay, well, for me, you know, I was waiting in the room with Rito, I believe Shunyo. Shunyo and Amrito, and Osho walked in, and he was just dressed in a lungi. And I mention that because the most beautiful thing for me in the session was watching him untie his lungi and then to retie it at the end of the session. And I can only say it was just the way he did it was so total awareness. And I think it was because, you know, I've never seen him tie and untie a lungi before. The way he looked down and untied his lungi was just made the biggest impression on me, because he had those delicate fingers untying his lungi, and I know he's done it thousands of times, and yet he had total awareness in the 5 or 10 seconds that he's tying and untying his lungi. And I don't know why, but that made the biggest impression in giving him the treatments. And then he lied down, and, you know, I took his pulse, and to get a feeling. And what my understanding was he was having trouble sleeping, as well as complications from the thallium poisoning that he got in the American jails. And I don't know how to explain it, but it was a little bit like right in the Pune One days, where I didn't know what to do and I just let him come through. It was a little bit like that, because there's so many choices in acupuncture, and all I could do was do what felt right in that moment without getting caught in my mind like, oh my God, I'm treating my master. I don't want to hurt him. I want to make sure I get the right point. I could have been very nervous, but somehow he helped me get very relaxed. He would make little jokes. Like when he first walked in, he said, "Hello, Abhiyana, I'm giving my body workers so much trouble." And I said, "No, it's no trouble at all." You know, but it was like, I know it was a way to make me relax with him, because, you know, I don't, for most of us, we only see him mostly in Buddha Hall, especially in the Pune 2, or on the ranch. We saw him from a distance up on a dais. Pune 1, there was the darshans, which were a little more intimate, but really this was the closest I've been to him ever since the darshans in Pune 1. So he did little jokes like that to help me relax. And I would do a point, an acupuncture point, and he would gesture. He says, "I feel it here." And he would point to somewhere else on his body that was far away from where I was doing. I was working around his ankles and he felt something in his shoulder. That's what I remember. And it was exactly on the meridian that I was working on, which most people do not have that kind of sensitivity.
Very interesting. Okay, fascinating. And did you feel any difference on top of what you just mentioned, that he was very sensitive to his body and he could feel the meridian? What else did you notice in terms of differences between treating the body of an enlightened master compared to treating the body of many other people you have treated who are non-enlightened?
Well, good question. And I wrote about it more in my book. His pulses were very unique. In the Chinese diagnostic system, there are pulses that are superficial, very close to the skin, and others that are deeper. And his superficial pulses, which are the yang pulses, were floating, almost like they were pressing up against my hand. And the yin pulses, the deeper ones, were sinking. And in the old Chinese medical books that are still used in the acupuncture school, 2,000-year-old Chinese medical books, they talk about the 9 death pulses. And one of the 9 death pulses is when the yang pulses, or the superficial pulses, are floating, and the yin, or the deep pulses, are sinking, exactly like his pulses were. Because they say that the yang, which represents the spirit, is going up, and the yin, which represents the body, is going down. And they're separating. In other words, the body's separating from whatever you want to call it, the soul, the spirit. So it would be considered a sign that he's dying in the Chinese system. And it was about 3 months before he left the body.
Have you ever treated the body of someone else who was about to die? And did you notice the same, or was it unique to Osho?
At the time I treated Osho in 1989, it was unique to me. But I have since then, but not as clearly as his pulses were. And what I didn't know is that maybe an enlightened man's pulses are always like that, because he's often said that since his enlightenment, he's no longer in the body. He's tethered to the body, but he's not in the body. And maybe that was the reflection the pulses were showing.
Would have been interesting for you to go maybe 10 years before and check his body and see if he had the same. Would have been fascinating. Or maybe if you have a chance to meet another enlightened master, you can do the pulse check.
Yes, I have not had that luxury to do that. I did give him herbal medicine in Pune 1. You know, that's also in the book. I was basically sent on a journey to get Chinese herbs for him. And but I would never actually diagnosed him or you know, I kind of chose the herbs based on what I knew about his health.
So during the sessions you gave him, did he talk to you? Did he give you any training on Chinese medicine or acupuncture or any insight that you learned specifically in those intimate moments with him?
You know, he did not. It wasn't a chatty session. Mostly it was just him receiving the session. And I felt his complete trust in my hands. That was very, very beautiful. He just wanted, you know, he literally, I don't know how to explain it too, but when he lied down, Within 2 or 3 seconds after lying down, he looked almost like a dead man. It's almost like I could hardly see he was breathing. You know, his color was good, but he didn't move a muscle. I don't know if that makes sense. I've never seen anybody like this. You know, they literally lie down and he completely relaxed. That's the best way of saying it. Every muscle in his body completely relaxed, like a dead body.
Wow, that's amazing.
Like in yoga. In yoga, they call it the corpse position.
Yeah, exactly. He says many times in his meditation, just feel as if you're dead. And I always think, you know, how is that possible?
Yes, well, he definitely modeled it for me, because that's basically it. But, and yet his body was very alive. It's really touching his body and working on his body was very sensitive and very alive and skin very smooth. It was very just a unique experience. And I've never treated anybody else on that level ever. I don't know what it means, except I'm grateful that I had that opportunity.
Wow, that's wonderful. And you're a lucky man. So
yes, I am.
Let's jump to more recent days. Recently, you published a book, a memoir of your own quest to know yourself, a kind of spiritual autobiography titled The Long Reach of the Dharma. So what was the inspiration for this book?
Well, for about 10 years, I've been feeling I had a book in me. And in my clinic, I often would tell people stories. They went, you know, I told stories about India or told stories about Osho. And people encouraged me, why don't you write your book? Why don't, you know, you have so many interesting stories. So it kind of encouraged me to do it and got stronger and stronger. And so finally, about 3 years ago, I just started writing. And writing is like catching a bug. It grabs you. And it's like, it's a beautiful sadhana to write a book. Even though it's very all consuming, sometimes I had to choose between sleep and writing. So I chose to write. And so for 2 years, pretty full time, it took me to write this book. It's 500 pages. It's a long book. And I didn't feel to divide it up. It starts with basically my birth and it goes until when Osho left the body. And it has many stories, some of the ones I've been mentioning in this podcast.
Okay, great. So this podcast is just a little teaser for more to come in the book.
Well, I've gotten beautiful reviews. People have written me and met, they've loved the book. And I'm just so grateful that I seem to have a knack for writing that I didn't know I had. I just had this compulsion to write that I felt I wanted to write. And I'm really happy I did. It's a great feeling to have it out and available. And to me, it tells a somewhat more complete story than some of the books that have been out on Osho, because it's more centered on my experience as well as in Oregon. It's not all the party lines, so to speak, as well as, you know, Pune 2 and Pune 3, I guess you could say, after Osho left the body. But it's, you know, it's centered around my experience, and which is, you know, being human. And, you know, sometimes it was not all, you know, it was not all easy. You know, when Osho left the body, I really fell apart. I had expectations that he was going to take me and everyone else with him into another dimension when he left the body. And something else happened. I would call it reality. I don't know what to call it, but I got to see my projections, let's say it that way, as Osho, as a savior, someone who is going to, the Messiah. You know, I have a Jewish conditioning and a Jewish upbringing, and it really touched on the Jews are still waiting for their Messiah. And it's a little bit like, I think that I had that going with Osho, that Messiah projection.
That's very powerful. In my understanding, the role of the master is to shatter all our conditionings and not to give us new ones. So I think he did the job with you.
Oh, he did the job with me. And many of, I think many, many of us. Not all, perhaps, but many.
Okay, wonderful. So thank you so much. And in terms of your latest projects, what are you up to? Of course, you've been working hard for years writing the book, but what's your current activities?
Well, my current activity is being a father. I have a 12-year-old daughter now who has been sort of supplanted my guru, which is kind of interesting. Since she was very young, she calls Osho my boss. So if I'm going to a meditation, she goes, "Oh, you're going to be with your boss." And I thought, wow, that's a really interesting comment. It's like she kind of sees it. So being a father, being a family, being in the world, running a clinic, I see about 40, 45 people a week. It's a lot. And I just turned 65. So this body's, you know, the stamina is a little bit less. But I have it in me to write at least two more books, one to continue where the last one left off. And I have many notes that I've been writing about it. But even though I don't have the same intense draw, with the, you know, the intense passion in writing that I did for the first, it'll maybe will come again. And a second book on Chinese medicine, my experiences with Chinese medicine. It's a tradition in China that when a person's been practicing as long as me, that they do write a book, or they bring their notes, they pass on their experience to the next generation. So I feel that's something also I want to do.
Well, I can feel the fire inside you is still very much there. So
yeah, it's true.
great enthusiasm and lots of projects ahead. So wonderful. So where people can find you if they want to know more about you, maybe get to know more about your activities and get your book, etc.?
I have a website, dharmareach.com. One word, dharmareach. And the book's also available on Amazon, USA, Germany, UK, and India.
Okay, great. And I'll link your website to the show notes.
I also have a website, SedonaAcupuncture.com, with a hyphen between the words Sedona and acupuncture. That's my clinic's website. So it has also information on me, and they're all linked together.
Okay, great. I'll link both of them in the notes. Perfect. Okay, so we're heading towards the end. I've got three final questions for you. And the first one is, what's your morning routine? How does your morning look like in the first couple of hours of your day?
Okay, well, depending on the season, where I live in Arizona, there's pretty strong seasons. So the sun either comes up early or comes up late. But I come to work at 8:30 in the morning. So depending on when I get up, my routine is different at different times of the year. I either go for a long walk. I usually have a cup of coffee and then meditate. And again, how long it is really depends on my timing since I start work. And some time with my family, with my wife, Madhu, my daughter, Shara Devi, and our two cats. So it's a very, you know, the mornings are usually simple. I drive my daughter to school, and I really enjoy that because it's a little bit of private time we have on my way to work.
Just a clarification, do you go for walks with your cats?
No, the cats are home. I don't take them to
okay.
work.
Fair enough. Okay. So, the second question is, what's your favorite meditation and why?
Well, my favorite meditation these days is listening to discourses. I'm listening to the Discipline of Transcendence, the discourses on Dhammapada. And really my meditation I love to do is go for morning walks, or sometimes it's afternoon or evening walks, listening to Osho. And that's always brings me to a space that's Kundalini is number two, but I love the walking meditation, listening to Osho.
Okay. So the last question is, you leave the Osho experiment. You were one of the pioneers in this movement of creating a new man, Zorba the Buddha. What does it mean to you personally to be with Osho today in 2018?
Two things come to mind with that. One is I'm working with my clients. My book, which has a huge picture of Osho right on the front cover, is my kind of my segue or talking point to bring Osho to people who are interested. And many people who've read my book, many of my clients buy my book, they say, well, can you recommend a book of Osho to us? And it's an opening. So Osho for me in 2018 is very much alive. It's in his words, and those people are ready is also his audio discourses, which I'm so grateful are available. And second is what it means for me personally. It's like when I still hear his voice from the discourses, it connects me to him in 2018, connects me to him in the here and now in a way. I almost every day I'm listening, I hear something on the discourse tape that is so appropriate. And I know many people have exactly the same experience, so appropriate to what's going on in my life right now. So I always hear something I need to hear.
Yeah, and that happens to me regularly. So I'm definitely with you on that. Thank you so much, Abhi. So that's the end of the show. I really enjoyed talking to you. I'm not sure how high was your stamina and energy level when you were 20, but I feel that you're 65 and you're really kicking asses. And that's amazing. You have so many projects. It's been a pleasure connecting with you.
I feel the same, Swaram. Thank you for what you're doing. I hope you continue for years to come. Everyone has a story, and if I've learned nothing else, everyone has an amazing story to tell. And it's a gift you're giving people like me to be able to say these things.
It's my absolute pleasure. And I'm just started, and there are hundreds and hundreds and thousands of sannyasin all over the world. So just keep them coming. I'm here for the long run.
Yay. So you keep up your stamina too.
yes, absolutely. Ash is my fuel. Okay,
okay, Abhi. My friend, thank you so much for this opportunity, and
my pleasure. Lots of love.
I hope we meet for a hug someday.
Absolutely, I'm up for it. Bye. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Lavo Show podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, you can show your appreciation by leaving a review on iTunes. Visit lavoshow.com for new episodes, blogs, and much more.